By any criteria, this is a strange choice of song to showcase Talking Heads. There is no "the" in the band's name. As underlined in their 1982 live double album, the name of the band is Talking Heads. Throughout their decade-long career, Talking Heads changed sounds and revolutionized popular music a number of times, and those milestones are much better served by choosing more typical fare from those vaunted albums. You couldn't do better to encapsulate their nervous, jittery early sound than to include their first hit, Psycho Killer. I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep 'cause my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho Killer. Or almost any track from their sophomore effort, the first of their Brian Eno produced trilogy, more songs about buildings and food. Let's go! You could illustrate their growing rhythmic awareness with the wonderful E. Zimbra from Fear of Music. Which foreshadows their reinvention as an African-styled band on the landmark Remain in Light album. Which was instrumental, some pun intended, in kicking off the world music movement of the 1980s and beyond. You could even argue for inclusion of something from the more stripped-down, funky Speaking in Tongues album, or even their return to guitar-driven pop documented on Little Creatures or True Stories. But nobody is going to pick a track that's buried on their largely ignored final album, an album that saw them, heard them, shifting gears again and taking on a whole new sound right before they disintegrated. But, as has been amply proven by now, this isn't about Talking Heads. It's about me, and of their long-limbed reach into my own personal music collection, perhaps there is no more significant track. I first encountered Talking Heads before I had heard of Talking Heads. I was on the cusp of adolescence, and I was visiting my grandmother, Oma, at her house in Seattle. Wandering around the neighborhood on my own one day, I walked down an alley behind the QFC grocery store. It was an exciting and confusing time. I was well on my way to manhood, but was still very much a child. I wanted to be on my own, but wasn't quite old enough to be trusted yet. There were many things I felt secure and smug about my knowledge of, and many others that were terrifying and intriguing mysteries. I see the shapes. I remember thumb maps. I see the shoreline. I see the white caps. A baseball diamond. In other words, I was 13, just entering my adolescence without having any idea what that really meant. I had recently stumbled into the heady and fathomless worlds of both music and sexual awareness and was struggling to come to terms with both of them. Walking down the alley, I felt dangerous and capable in an urban environment. I was far from either dangerous or capable, or even an urban environment, but it all seemed pretty edgy at the time. I noticed that somebody had sprayed some graffiti on the wall. Among the usual boasts and obscenities, "The girls want to be with the girls" was dripping down the whitewashed brick wall in sloppy red spray-painted letters. That stopped me. What did that mean? Was it a sexual thing? A political thing? A gender thing? I didn't understand. I knew someday I would know what that meant, but I also knew that day was a long way away, and as sophisticated and capable as I sometimes felt, seeing those mysterious words, words which meant so much to somebody that they painted them on a public wall in direct violation of the law, I knew I was still just a kid. I kicked a can hard down the alley and scuffled back to Oma's house for lunch. Years later, 3 to be exact, I was in dance class at the Interlochen Arts Academy, a junior who had recently made the jump to the higher levels of study to become a full-fledged dance major.
Okay, go.
I had entered Interlochen refusing to pursue the viola anymore and aiming to be an actor. I had just seen A Chorus Line in Seattle and was so affected by it and had such a longing for that kind of life and attention that I dropped out of the local junior high to enter the Arts Academy a year earlier than I had planned. But acting wasn't really for me. I liked being on stage and performing, but I could never get my damn voice to behave and do what I thought it should. No accents came out correctly, no inflection was plausible. I was able to suspend nobody's disbelief for even one moment, especially, and most critically, my own.
Turns to me and he says, "Okay, Morales, what did you feel?" And I said, "Nothing, I'm feeling nothing." And he says, "Nothing could get a girl transferred." They all felt something, but I felt nothing, except the feeling that this bullshit was absurd.
I tried my hand at photography for my sophomore year, but I hadn't developed much of a visual sense by then, and the few interesting prints I came up with that year were entirely accidental, so I switched to dance. That way I could be on stage without having to worry about being betrayed by my voice. I made the switch despite, or perhaps because of, my parents' deep misgivings. They were both dancers, so they knew from whence they spoke, but I didn't care. I had been taking dance class for those first 2 years because there was a physical education requirement for underclassmen, and I didn't want to suffer through phys ed anymore after having survived the humiliating and downright dangerous junior high gym classes. I really liked the physical challenge and sense of accomplishment I got from dance class. I advanced quickly through the introductory levels and had jumped the enormous chasm between level 2 and level 3. Part of my rapid rise through the ranks was because I was a guy, and there's a different set of criteria, and much less competition, for male dancers as there is for female dancers. And part of it was that I was perhaps genetically predisposed to do well in dance, as both parents were accomplished classically trained ballet dancers.
Yeah.
At any rate, at the end of the year, there was a student choreography showcase for those dancers, level 4, that took choreography class. And though not in the choreography class, level 4, the hardcore dancers, took their academics in the morning and danced all afternoon. Level 3 had their 3 hours of dance in the morning and sat, sweaty and stinking, through their afternoon academics. Still, I was in the pool of eligible dancers to be used for the choreography workshop performance and was recruited into a couple of pieces. One of them used a piece from Talking Head's second album, More Songs About Buildings and Food, called Take Me to the River. I didn't know it at the time, but it's a cover of a famous Al Green soul classic. What I did know about it was that, with the exception of the treated drums that introduced the piece, I hated it. The vocals were pinched and grating, the music lurched more than it flowed, and the whole affair seemed awkward. But, since I was in a dance piece that was choreographed to it, I had the dubious pleasure of getting to hear it several dozen times over the course of a couple of weeks, and it did start to grow on me. I never liked the song as much as those few treated beats that set the tempo for the song, and still don't, but the door had been opened to the world of Talking Heads. I borrowed and listened to that album a couple of times, but didn't really like any of it, so gave it back and didn't pursue them any further. The music was strange and jerky and favored odd tempo changes and minimalist arrangements, but the worst of it was the awful vocals. The singer clearly couldn't sing at all and yelped his vocals out like a paranoid street corner preacher. And the lyrics were just absurd. They had no sense of poetry to them. They often didn't even rhyme, and they were, in general, so mundane as to be unbelievable. Why would you write a song about going to the grocery store? It just didn't make sense to me. Judy's in the bed room, inventing situations. Bobby's on the street today, scouting up locations. They enlisted all their family. They enlisted all their friends. Their pups and their relationship. I did notice, though, that there was a song on the album called The Girls Want to Be with the Girls, but hearing it didn't really clear up the issue for me, other than now I knew where that graffito came from. Talking Heads followed a long and honored tradition of starting at an art school. For years, it has seemed that some of the best bands come out of art schools, which makes you wonder where the artists are coming from. At any rate, Talking Heads started when David Byrne met Chris Frantz and his girlfriend Tina Weymouth at the Rhode Island School of Design, and they decided to move to New York City and get a Soho loft and do the whole downtown art scene.
Well, look, see, there's an abominable snowman in the supermarket. And apparently the housewives have never seen anything like that before.
They recruited keyboardist Jerry Harrison from Jonathan Richman's band, The Modern Lovers.
Get that snow thing out of this store.
And Talking Heads was born.
Baltimore snowman in the market. That's right, you heard me right, gang. And the housewives, they all remark, it looks like a dirty marshmallow with fangs. Well, there's a vulnerable snowman in the market. Now he's down by the peas and carrot. A vulnerable snowman in the market, and they cannot chase him away. What you say? Vulnerable snowman in the market. All right. Oh, vulnerable snowman in the market. Oh my.
Jonathan Richman is an important figure in the underground downtown music scene because he did not fall easily into either of the two big musical camps that had circled their wagons around their large and distinctive bonfires. Richman sang quirky and sweet pop songs in a low-key and charmingly amateurish, almost childish way, and gave inspiration to musicians who didn't want to be part of either the establishment or the established anti-establishment.
Vulnerable snowman man, and we have to say something that he can understand. That's right, there's a vulnerable snowman in the market, and he's doing better every day.
The popular music scene was famously bloated and stagnant by that time, with bands like Fleetwood Mac and Foreigner spending obscene amounts of money and time in the studio crafting their elaborately ornate pop and getting farther and farther away from what rock and roll was supposed to be about. But, more importantly, they were starting to drift from what the people wanted to hear. And perhaps most importantly of all, they weren't inspiring any other bands. What they were doing was so far from what was even conceivable by young guitar heroes as to make the whole enterprise of trying to be a musician seem impossible and unrewarding. As a reaction to this, of course, were the punks, named after a downtown zine, before they were called that, and famously stripping rock back to its three-chord blitzkrieg bop, all energy and brevity with a refreshing do-it-yourself aesthetic and an endearing lack of polish, or talent, or taste, it may be argued. Punk was led by the Ramones before the British stole it and politicized it and codified the look and re-imported it back stateside. And the center of the punk universe, the venue at which the Ramones and their ilk held court, was a small Bowery dive known as CBGB's. In fact, the music that made CBGB's famous took quite a while to take hold even there. The Ramones, unsigned, unheard, thought it would be cool to find a home club, someplace where they'd play often enough that people would know where to find them.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh.
And though they were from Queens, there was no doubt you had to be in Manhattan to make the scene. But most of the clubs at that time were notoriously difficult to play. Especially if you played the extremely unfashionable kind of music the Ramones played, which was neither smooth pop nor disco, the two-headed hydra that ruled the scene at the time.
What can you do? What can you do? With a brand like that, throws on your
Stumbling across an unknown club in a bad part of town, but still in Manhattan, they approached the owner of the newly opened CBGB's to see if he'd be willing to give them a chance. He was wary because he had just booked what was to become the enormously influential, in a Velvet Underground sort of way, band Television, and was very disappointed. The band was sloppy and loud, and the few people that did show up, mostly the band's friends, not only couldn't afford drinks, they didn't even shell out the $1 cover charge. But he was having trouble finding anybody else to play, and a promoter assured him that the Ramones were huge out in Queens, and the place would be packed. That was a bald-faced lie. The Ramones were huge exactly nowhere, and Hilly hated them even more than he hated Television. But he let them play a few more times, and the rest, as they say, is heresy. History. Actually, what really made CBGB's the epicenter was the unprecedented decision by Hilly Kristal to not only let bands play original material, but to demand that the bands play original material. At that point, the only way to play at a club in New York City was either as a cover band, in which original material was strictly verboten, or if you had a recording contract. When Hilly opened the doors to original bands with no recording contract, the flood began and punk and new wave were born. This last point is often overlooked. Everybody knows that CBGB is where punk came from, but people tend to forget about the new wave. Not every band that played there copied the Ramones' three-minute, three-chords formula. Blondie may have started slightly punky, but they were really a new wave band, and arguably the most successful band to come out of the CBGB stable. The other band that could challenge Blondie on all fronts, new wave stylings, influence on other musicians, and widespread popular success, was Talking Heads.
When my love stands next to your love, I can't compare love.
By this time, the Heads were all living together in a Soho loft, and practicing late into the night in their empty building.
It's not love. It's not love. Which is my face. Which is a building. Which is on fire. On fire.
In trying to come up with a name for the band, always one of the most important and often most contentious decisions for a new band, somebody, probably David Byrne, suggested Talking Heads, which is a television production term for the kind of Meet the Press program that features shots of, well, talking heads. Tina put the name on a t-shirt and was walking around town and some guy stopped her and asked if it was the name of a band. She said it was, and he shook his head, declaring it perhaps the worst band name in all of history. So they kept it.
Too long.
Although they played regularly at CBGB's, under no circumstances could Talking Heads be considered a punk band, except in the extremely broad definition that punk is anything that wasn't blessed by a corporation. Talking Heads was geek rock, the antithesis of the kind of swaggering, testosterone-soaked cock rock played out in huge arenas by bands such as Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones. They were intellectual and proud of it, or at least unapologetic, and they sang quirky songs about working for the government and being modestly happy about it, or trying to be an artist, or flying over the countryside, or making videotapes. Or, very occasionally, flying off the handle and killing everybody. In general, they were small people singing small songs about small things. Their early aesthetic is summed up in their second album title, More Songs About Buildings and Food. Which, incidentally, pictures the band on the cover in hundreds of overlapping close-up Polaroids, a technique that would be borrowed, shall we say, to great success and notoriety by David Hockney a few years later.
Let's go!
The band was solid, even though their songs were quirky, but the real focal point was the vocals of David Byrne.
I'm painting! I'm painting!
His lyrics were literate and subtle when they weren't downright banal, but his vocal style was shrill and harsh. He sounded nervous and jumpy whenever he sang, and the effect not only inspired lots of other non-singers to take up the task, but also gave the band a slightly menacing sound, especially in their first hit, Psycho Killer, in which it's very easy to imagine the tightly wound Byrne coming undone and causing severe collateral damage. More Songs About Buildings and Food was the first album produced by Brian Eno, and he shepherded them through two more. The second of those, Fear of Music, finds the band polishing their sound, pushing the dynamics envelope, and developing their interest in rhythms and polyrhythms.
Do you remember anyone here? No, you don't remember anything at all. I'm sleeping hot. There's a party in my mind, and I hope it never stops. There's a party up there all the time, and a party to the drum. Other people can go. Everybody else rest away. I'll be here all the time. I can never
quit. Fear of Music is a darker album than the two that came before, suffused with paranoia and uncertainty, even as the music becomes more solid and self-assured, even funky.
Thank you.
It took a while, and perhaps a nudge, before I realized that Fear of Music didn't express a fear of music, but was music about fears. If you read down the song list, almost all of which are one-word titles, the album becomes a list of phobias.
I say to myself, what is happening to my skin? Where is that protection that I needed?
So it isn't so much that the songs are about air and cities and paper and heaven, but a fear of those things. Fear of drugs, fear of mind, fear of animals, fear of heaven, and their hit from the album and one of the best songs in the repertoire, Fear of Life During Wartime. Life During Wartime was the track that really started to turn the Talking Heads tide for me. Early in my exploration of New Wave, I had very little money to spend, so each purchase was an agonizing decision, since I knew I'd have to live with it for a month until I had enough scratch to pick up another record. So cheap 10-inch EPs and compilations were especially appreciated. And one of the best compilations I ever picked up was a double disc soundtrack to an awful movie. Well, I haven't seen all of it, but what I've seen is pretty bad. Called Times Square. Australian impresario Robert Stigwood made a fortune with his high concept musical films, Grease for one example, Saturday Night Fever for another, before flaming out and losing popular credibility after the expensive disaster of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, starring the Bee Gees as the band and Peter Frampton as Billy Shears.
John was quizzical, studied pataphysical science in the home. Late nights, all alone with a test tube.
And the box office failure of Times Square, which was supposed to be a gritty punk new wave musical featuring cult actor Tim Curry as a DJ who discovers a girl band who plays on top of a movie marquee in Times Square, or something like that. If the movie was bad and short-lived, the soundtrack turned out to be an extremely important document in my early collecting. Perhaps the single most important collection in terms of introducing me to artists that would become significant to me. Although there are a few clunkers on the album, there is an astonishing number of tracks by significant bands, most of which I heard for the first time on this album.
Down in the park where the Mac Men made the machines and play kill by numbers. Down in the park where the Franco 5.
didn't always include the most well-known songs from these artists, but that hardly mattered. Any album that manages to include songs from Talking Heads, Gary Numan, XTC, The Pretenders, Joe Jackson, The Ruts, The Ramones, Lou Reed, Roxy Music, Patti Smith, and The Cure can't be all bad. At any rate, Life During Wartime is featured on the album, and I immediately took to it. The lyrics are great. For once, Burns' downplayed laundry list style of mundane songwriting really fits the subject, and the track's chilling minor-keyed funkiness makes it a compelling listen. Fear of Music was a significant, though transitional, album, in that it was built up from jams instead of being written like more traditional songs. Consequently, the groove became the overriding concern, and many songs hovered on the same key to facilitate the jams. The ridiculous predictability of the 12-bar blues makes it difficult to listen to for long, but lots of fun to play, as you always know what the next chord is and when it's coming up. This was to be a significant development in the band, and their next album, Remain in Light, exploited this jamming aesthetic. Capitalizing on both Brian Eno and David Byrne's interest in African music, the two were busy working on their collaboration, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, Talking Heads expanded into an 11-piece outfit and took the principles of African music to heart in the songwriting and especially the arrangements.
Sometimes the world has a load of questions. Seems like the world knows nothing at all. The world is near, but it's out of reach. Some people touch it, but they can't hold on. She is loving to describe the world. The world. She has messages for everyone. The world. She is moving by remote.
Rejecting the competition model of popular music, in which each member tries to outdo the others with their pyrotechnic solos, Eno and Byrne experimented with interlocking musical parts, in which no one instrument would carry the melody or could be considered a solo. Each part fit together with each other part, and no part could stand alone. The result was a dense, polyrhythmic weave, and it touched off a revolution in the way lots of bands approached music for the next several years. For details, hear the extremely erudite and entertaining taped lecture demonstration,
Bridging the Gap, African Culture and American Popular Music During the Early 1980s.
I heard Remain in Light for the first time the same week that I heard the band Japan for the first time. Early in my senior year at Interlaken, a heady time when every time I turned around, I was confronted with some amazing new sound or fantastic new band.
I'm walking young and strong, but just a little too thin now. Maybe happy, but I haven't a clue to this life. In my mind, stay with me, we could learn to fight like
Although short of singles, only the sublime Once in a Lifetime cracked the charts, but just barely, Remain in Light was one of the most important albums of the 1980s, and it was fairly popular, too.
And you may find yourself chef, and you may find yourself in another part of the world, and you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife, and you may ask yourself,
somehow, Talking Heads had managed to achieve popular success without pandering to the masses. They were pioneers in what came to be known as college rock, slightly more cerebral and less popular than your garden variety pop, with somewhat more demanding song structures and arrangements, as well as subject matter, paving the way for such bands as R.E.M. in later years.
Same as it ever was.
Remain in Light is a phenomenal album, and much more varied than one might expect for an album based on instrumental jams. Alternatingly bracing, heartbreaking, wistful, and invigorating, it is a tour de force, and generally considered their finest moment. It includes songs about midlife crises, third world resistance to first world progress, and closes with a dense, dark, molasses-slow, one-chord dirge, The Overload, which recasts Yeats' The Second Coming as a fragmented tone poem.
Signal to weave, to even recognize.
It raised the bar considerably and sent many bands back to the drawing boards. It must have burned their heads out somewhat too, as 3 years passed before their next studio release. Fill up the vacuum, Talking Heads released a wonderful live album, as wonderful as live album gets anyway, which usually isn't very, called The Name of the Band is Talking Heads. Rather than a document commemorating a particular show, The Name of the Band includes tracks from their earliest days to their full-blown, earth-shaking, 11-piece Afro-funk lineup. One side of the album cover shows the band at their muscliest, with their full Remain in Light complement on stage jamming, and the other, intriguingly, shows the original four playing in what looks like someone's living room for about a dozen people. When they finally did return to the studio to record a new album for 1983, they did so without Brian Eno. Although he and David Byrne got along well, Eno's cerebral approach and abhorrence of anything popular started wearing on the other members, so in the interim, everybody stretched out on their own projects. David Byrne scored Twyla Tharp's massive dance project, The Catherine Wheel, to great effect. That soundtrack, Remain in Light, and My Life in the Bush of Ghosts are all of one piece, as far as I'm concerned, and mark the pinnacle of David Byrne's creativity. Jerry Harrison, the keyboardist they recruited from the Modern Lovers, came out with a fair solo album and started producing albums for other bands. In the rhythm section, drummer Chris Frantz and bassist Tina Weymouth, who reportedly chose her instrument because it was the most annoying, got together with some friends from the Remain in Light days and Tina's sisters to create Tom Tom Club as a venue for their more sacrilegiously commercial impulses. They returned as a stripped-down foursome with the highly regarded Speaking in Tongues, which largely abandoned their thickly layered and intricately intertwined African sound for a more minimalist, funky approach.
Watch out. You might get what you're after. Cool babies.
Speaking in Tongues, released on the day I finally left the University of Chicago for a life unknown, was their most popular album, and it does contain a few wonderful tracks, including what is probably their biggest hit, Burning Down the House. And their most beautiful and sublime track. The sweet album closing, This Must Be the Place. An uncharacteristically genuine ode to domestic bliss and love, especially surprising coming from the usually cynical and paranoid Byrne, who sings the song beautifully and with heart-happy joy. This is where I started to lose them. Another live album. This time the soundtrack to Jonathan Demme's documentary of their Speaking in Tongues tour called Stop Making Sense brought them even wider acclaim and acted as a sort of greatest hits package, continuing their run of unlikely public success. Speaking in Tongues was huge when it came out, and I heard it all the time as I was getting to know my way around the Big Bad Apple. I played it a lot that summer, and grew to like most of the album, but they were drifting away from the sounds and themes that interested me. And by the next album, 1985's Little Creatures, they had turned another corner and disappeared down another street, but this time, I couldn't follow them.
There's a word for it. Words don't mean a thing. There's a name for it. The names make all the difference in the world. Some things can never be spoken. Some things cannot be pronounced. That word does not exist in any language. It will never be uttered by you.
Little Creatures is stripped down even further and is played as a mostly straight guitar band, almost country at times. Byrne's paranoia continues to ebb and his domestic bliss continued to flow and I just didn't care anymore. Plus, he seemed to be going for a kind of forced faux naivety, which felt entirely disingenuous and a little insulting. This was also about the time that Byrne directed his film True Stories, which is nearly unwatchable. Actually, I went to go see it with Oma, my grandmother, and it did provide one of my most cherished memories of her. She was always an incredibly good sport, and willing to try anything at least once, so when I told her during a visit that I was interested in seeing this film, she eagerly agreed, and we jumped in the car and drove to the theater. We took our seats and the lights went down. The movie started, and after a couple of minutes, she leaned over and asked, "Is this the movie?" I assured her that it was, and 10 minutes later, she was fast asleep. She always was a wily critic. Byrne released an album of music from the film, Sounds from True Stories, which is actually quite a charming little treasure, featuring everything from the Kronos Quartet to cowboy tunes to disco to Meredith Monk. But for some reason, he decided to recast most of the songs as Talking Heads songs, and their next and worst album was also called True Stories. I don't know if he thought the songs wouldn't stand up in their original forms, or if he was out of ideas, or if he thought it would be a good set of songs for Talking Heads, but whatever the motivation, the album is flat and uninteresting and continues with a disingenuous ingenue angle. That should have been it for me and Talking Heads, but cool bands die slowly for me, and I'm almost always willing to give them another chance. So, when what would turn out to be their final album, Naked, was released early in 1988, I picked it up. Talking Heads had turned another corner and went down another street, and this time I was happy to follow them. They were going forward by going backwards and sideways. They built their songs from jams again and invited lots of additional musicians to fill out the ranks and took a more rhythmic approach to their music than they had since the Remain in Light days. But this time, instead of looking to Africa for inspiration, they went south of the border. Naked utilizes a much more of a South American palette, and many of the funky songs have an irresistible groove to them. This time, their polyrhythmic jams were punctuated not by creepy synthesizer stabs, but by blaring horn sections. A much more danceable effort than anything they had done since Speaking in Tongues, Naked invigorated the band, and the music was the most energetic and infectious it had been for years. It seemed like they were back on track, but alas, it was not meant to be. The public largely ignored the album, and Tina and Chris were eventually surprised to find out that Talking Heads had broken up by reading an interview with David Byrne. This created no small friction between the band members, and eventually led to Jerry, Chris, and Tina forming a band called The Heads with a parade of guest lead vocalists. To rub salt in the wound, they called the album No Talking, Just Head, which, in addition to its double entendre, irked David Byrne so much that he tried to sue them, although the suit was quietly dropped later. The band that rose from the womb of punk, made it safe to think and rock at the same time, virtually invented college rock, turned the world onto multicultural cross-pollination, brought funk back to the foreground, and released one of the most vibrant and varied catalogs in rock, had finally called it a night and went their separate ways. Of those separate ways, David Burns was the most successful. Not surprising, really, as he was the singer and most visible member of the band. His solo albums after their breakup almost all suck, but he founded a highly regarded label called Luwaka Bop, which, honorably enough, is dedicated to giving more attention to the obscure artists that inspire Burns.
Well, there are 16 people in Danny's apartment. 16.
Although David Byrne as a Latin dance artist is laughably bad, his label has some good, solid, important releases, including the sublime Belize Tropical, the first album on the label, and a stunning collection of Brazilian music that introduced many, myself included, to the wonders of Brazilian pop. But all of this is beside the point and doesn't answer the question of why I would choose an obscure track from their little regarded swan song to showcase Talking Heads. The real reason is that Naked in general, and Totally Nude in particular, is what I finally lost my virginity to. The woman that was to become G, my wife and mother of my children, started those events during the early part of our last year at Hampshire College, when she gave me a neck rub during a video workshop. That led to a conversation in the airport lounge, a sparsely populated student center at Hampshire, which led inexorably and over a period of many months to our union as soulmates.
We could be the last two on earth to start. You and me, girl, try. And you can almost see.
I had come to college, like millions before me, and like millions after me, to get laid. There were other reasons, of course, but that was certainly one of them. I was having no luck meeting anybody in New York, at least anybody that wasn't gay. And I was getting tired of the daily work grind, so I decided that maybe the problem at University of Chicago hadn't been college in general, but that college in particular. So I looked around until I found a school that was the least like U of C in every important way. And that school was the relatively young, fairly radical Hampshire College. Instead of a pointless and frustrating core of classes that you had to take, Hampshire offered complete academic freedom and the opportunity to design your own program of study. Nothing seemed more appealing, so after a quick and frantic application period started about a month before classes began, I found myself with bag in hand at a school I had never visited, preparing to live there for the next few years. It was a bit rough at the beginning, but after a difficult semester adjusting to the surroundings, I found my niches and happily got to work. My divisions, the projects you collaborated on with faculty members that allowed you to progress through the system on your way to graduation, were starting to fall into place, and I was making connections with faculty members and other students, and was fairly happily humming along through my academic program. My sexual program, however, was not working out so well. By this time, it was becoming undeniably clear that the problem wasn't from circumstances, but was coming from within. In high school, everybody was too young and inexperienced and eager but nervous. At U of C, everyone was too cerebral and ugly. And in New York City, everybody was far too guarded and suspicious. But Hampshire was a little rabbit hutch of sexual activity, something that health services would sometimes note with bemusement as certain creepy crawlies made their way through the student body. Despite this, I was still most painfully a virgin. It wasn't for lack of trying. Well, okay, it was. It was because I was trapped in a vicious circle from which I could see no way out. I was shy around women because I had no experience, and the few opportunities that I did have ended in shame and humiliation for me, which just made me all the more shy. If another opportunity presented itself, I'd start stressing, which would just exacerbate the problem, which made my physical failure a foregone conclusion, which would just add more pressure, and so on. There are a few years in your, hopefully, late teens and early 20s when everybody is trying to figure out their equipment and how it connects to other people's equipment. But that time was rapidly coming to an end, and I was still very much on the outside looking in. I had just about given up hope when I felt the warm hands of salvation on my neck. But of course, it wasn't quite so easy. The hands belonged to Chris, who had a boyfriend or two, and although I was powerfully attracted to her, I couldn't bring myself to say anything about it. Plus, I didn't want to be an excuse for her to break up with her boyfriends. I wanted her to break up with them on her own before our relationship turned physical. But mostly, I was just paralyzed by fear. So I took comfort in her friendship, and that blossomed into a flower of rare beauty. We were pretty inseparable that year, to the point where everybody just assumed we were together. But I was used to that. What I used to take as rejection, "Oh, you're such a good friend, just like a brother," was becoming my refuge, and I reveled in my friendships with women, even when they got twisted into something confusing and upsetting. I knew I could be a friend, and I knew I couldn't be a lover, so I poured all of my frustrated loving into being a friend. But it was a cover, and I knew it. As the year went on, Chris and I got closer. We'd often stay up deep into the night talking and end up spending the night together, sleeping in the same bed, but we never crossed the romantic or sexual line, as difficult as it sometimes was. One night, while we were sleeping together in my impossibly small dorm bed, I had a dream that we were in my impossibly small dorm bed one night making out. And then I woke up in the still darkness and couldn't remember if it had really happened or if it was just a dream. Alas, it was a dream, but it was a beautiful one, and was as close as I ever thought I'd get to real physical intimacy with somebody else. In the spring, with the running of the sap and the melting of the ice, things became almost unbearable. We were spending practically every waking moment and most of our sleeping ones together, but I was still fervently, hopelessly denying my feelings. Because I knew that if we crossed that golden line in the sand, that my body would fail me again, and it would screw up our friendship. She realized that I really was just a good friend, and would wander off somewhere else to get her sensual needs met, and I'd be left alone again. So, as much as I wanted to try to consummate our relationship and push it into a new area, I didn't want it just as strongly. I was doomed. One night, Chris and I volunteered to help out at a dance in the cafeteria, and we ended up back in my room, slightly drunk and sweaty from the activities. We were sitting on the bed talking, and she suddenly kissed me, just like that. I was shocked and delighted, and we fell back into the bed and gently made out for a few minutes before drifting off to sleep in each other's arms. When I awoke, I was alone, but nervously ecstatic. We had finally both acknowledged our attraction and, for better or worse, had crossed over into a new frontier. I showered and ate breakfast and reported to the audiovisual equipment office, where I worked a few hours a week checking cameras and PAs and the like into and out of the office. Halfway through my shift, Chris showed up to say hi. I was buzzing with excitement as she came up to the counter, and I grinned conspiratorially at her. She smiled back, somewhat puzzled, and said something to the effect of, "Boy, I got so drunk last night, I don't remember a thing that happened after we left the dance."
Yes, we're gonna have a wedding. Summer smoke around the ground. It's just the dugout that my dad built.
I was flabbergasted and crushed. I couldn't believe she would stoop to such an obviously cliched position. Either she was lying, which was so out of what I thought her character was that I'd have to severely reevaluate our relationship, or she wasn't lying, and this remarkable, exciting, glorious moment meant so little to her that she couldn't even remember it 8 hours later. Either way, I was devastated. Speechless, I motioned that I had to get back to work and help the next person in line check in their video camera outfit, watching her wander uncertainly back into the library. Later, she caught up with me and apologized. She said she hadn't remembered, but when she saw me, and, more importantly, smelled me, she knew something had changed, and it came back to her as she wandered, confused, back through the library. I warily accepted her apology, and later that night, we tried kissing again, this time completely sober. And this time, she remembered it in the morning. Things progressed quickly. Well, no, they didn't. On our timetable, which was more like the days of courting from the 18th century than anything anybody was doing after the sexual revolution of the 1960s and the hedonistic disco age of the 70s, things progressed quickly. Chris was patient and understanding and willing to talk things through and listen even when I had nothing to say and help me try to understand why I had so much trouble expressing my desire physically. We talked about past failures and upsetting moments and experiments that had gone horribly awry. Because we had built up such a strong bond over such a long period of months, our friendship wasn't shattered when I couldn't respond, and, eventually, I found that I could. It was a slow and scary road, but ultimately, with her loving patience and encouragement, at the ripe old age of 23, I was able to leap over the last barrier and officially remove the stigma of virginity. As usual, there was lots of music I was listening to at the time, but Naked was at the top of the list, and it became one of our records, especially the song Totally Nude.
Big and I'm bad, and I want you to know
We were both rejoicing that we had found someone we could be comfortable with while being totally nude, and it became our theme song that spring and into the summer. We moved in together after graduation and haven't been apart since. And that's why, more than the paranoia of Psycho Killer, or the wary funk of life during wartime, or the world fusion of once in a lifetime, the gleeful career-ending joy of being totally nude will always be the quintessential Talking Heads song to me. Through Chris's patience and insight, I was able to begin to understand my sexuality better. Although I am enthusiastically heterosexual, and my equipment is clearly of the plug-and-play variety, my sexuality is more feminine than stereotypically masculine. Romance was more important to me than sex. One of the reasons I had close female friends was that I could relate to them in a way that was not sexually threatening. Even horny as hell, I was careful never to objectify women and could easily open up a space of tenderness and respect between us. I wanted sex, sure, but I wanted love even more, and that made me fairly unusual among adolescent boys. Girls could let their guard down with me in a way they couldn't with a lot of other guys. The girls want to be with the girls, and so do I.